Hey, welcome to the Morning Mic Check. I'm Pat Brown here with Mike Metzger. Mike and I have known each other for a while now. I first met him around 2010, and he's become one of the key mentors in my life. Over the years, we've had countless conversations, and in almost every one, I've walked away having discovered something new. Mike has this unique ability where he can reframe a conversation, and you begin to discover a deeper reality around you. It's a bit like Alice tumbling down the rabbit hole. I'm releasing these conversations as an invitation to follow me as I go down that rabbit hole. Well, good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Pat.
You know, this greeting just never gets old. Same thing every time.
Well, in a marriage, it's called telling your spouse you love her. It should never get old. If it does, we have a problem.
Well, we're going to continue talking about high-performance leadership. Last time we talked, we spent the entire time talking about one of four, the first of four kind of pieces to that, and that was returning authority or returning dominion. And we fleshed out, I think part of the reason it took so long is because there's such a deep connection to where this overlaps with some of the past conversations we've had on dominion. And one of the big pieces to returning authority is discerning authority and understanding, discerning dominion. And we've talked about how important that is to begin to understand, even as simple as sitting across from someone else, there immediately is this from 1 to 100, you know, how much dominion do you have with this person? And that's important for a number of reasons, but one of those is you can actually do a lot of damage in that relationship. Again, whether it's friends, whether it's coworkers, whether it's a boss, if you attempt to exercise dominion or authority that you simply do not have. So an important piece to being a high performing leader is first and foremost discerning dominion. And we can kind of carry on there. So that's one of four. Where do we go from here, Mike?
Well, we might just again give a real quick example for dominion that will again help all of us, because gosh, for a long time this wouldn't have made any, this would have been language I wasn't that familiar with. But think of it in this regard, that your set of keys you carry around indicate your dominion. And so keys are dominion. I have a key to this house. So if you think about it, as Pat just said, between yourself and an object, there's 100% dominion. But when we're talking about an inanimate object, like a key, you have 100% dominion. So if I put this key in this lock, this door locks. If it doesn't lock, it's not a willful decision on the part of the lock. I am not going to operate the way you want me to. And so this is we hear this in the Bible when Jesus says, I give you the keys to the kingdom. So we are given a level of authority. And when it's an inanimate object, when I turned the faucet on this morning for a glass of water, the water came out. The faucet wasn't making any decision. When you're dealing with objects that are not inanimate, so another person, and you're having a conversation, there still, again, exists between the two of you only 100% dominion, not more, not less. And as Pat just pointed out, the high-performing leader, the first thing they do is discern, how much authority do I have here, actual authority? Most individuals overestimate their level of authority, especially if you are in a position of leadership in an organization. So I've joked with my pastor friends, because I was a pastor for 8 years, that you assume when you stand up to give a sermon, you have 100% authority because they're sitting there. Well, the only authority that you might actually have is they're slightly raising the temperature of the room, but their thoughts are a million miles away. Second, we also know that studies show that on average, about 10% of a congregation is actually inclined when they walk in to do anything about what they're going to hear. And so again, even when I preached, I never assumed I had much authority here. That's why we've talked, perhaps not here, but that's why TED is actually a better example right now of effective communicators, the famous TED Talks, because they rely on neuroscience that says that even if people want to pay attention, at this time in our history, the average American, even if you're the most engaging speaker in the world, only pays attention for about 18 minutes, no more than that. After that, even if they're sitting there, even if they're taking notes, even if they're making eye contact, they're not retaining. And so effective leaders, even in preaching, discern how much authority they have. And when they preach beyond 18 minutes, they're essentially saying, I don't care whether or not I have authority. I have positional authority in this pulpit, and I'm going to motor on. So this is everywhere. It's in meetings that I've sat in business meetings where you realize you look around and say, no one's really paying attention anymore. But the boss has carved out this 30-minute talk they want to give or a presentation they want to give and so on and so forth. So this discerning levels, your actual level of authority, critical in any conversation with any human being or groups of human beings. And it's been particularly helpful for Kathy and I in our conversations because it's just easy to assume you have far more authority than you actually have.
Yeah, that's great. The sermon is actually a good point to illustrate that authority, dominion is constantly changing as well. It's not like you can just establish it with someone and then you're good. But even during a simple conversation, that the levels can shift depending on how that conversation is going.
And I think that's why I love the final scene or one of the final scenes in Saving Private Ryan, because what does the sergeant tell Private Ryan? Earn it. And literally saying, you've been bought with a price. Now earn it. And earning it simply means you have a level of dominion, but it's if you want to actually make the most of this, you have to earn a level of dominion. If you walk home and just say, hey, I was saved and this is great, you're not living a good life. You've got to earn this. And that is actually the same thing we see in the Bible. We're saved by grace through faith, but the faith that saves is never alone. Paul wrote, work out your salvation with fear and trembling. Earn dominion. Just because you're a believer and Jesus said, all authority has been given to me, all authority hasn't been given to you in the places where we work. You've got to earn cultural capital.
Yeah, that's a good summary. So where does that go from there, Mike?
Well, the three other characteristics of high-performing leaders, we're going to give you just a snapshot, and then we'll go back and revisit each one, is second, a high-performing leader uses the word we far more than the word I. And that's what is often called mutuality. Second, they understand that the nature of the problem is far more complex than they initially understand. So high-performing leaders see problems as systemic, and they promote systemic solutions. So the first one is we over I. Second, they think systems. And the third is they focus on results. So let's go back and revisit each one, mutuality or we over I. Second, they understand complexity. The problem they're facing is far more complex than they initially understand. Think systems. And then last, they focus on results. So let's go back to that first one. So in summary, again, the four characteristics of high-performing leaders: they discern authority, they unconsciously say we far more than I. Third, they think about problems as complex and think systems. And fourth, they focus on results.
Yeah. And we're saying 1, 2, 3, 4 here, but even as you're saying it, I like in my mind, I mean, there is this sort of, it's more circular in that they sort of all play off each other.
That's right.
You start to understand mutuality a little bit deeper when you understand where authority is in the room, especially when it comes to groups and understanding there. And when you are, as we talked the last time, in trying to discern dominion, you often realize there's some deeper complexity here than I originally thought, which naturally again spins back into, oh, this is not a problem I can actually solve. This is a problem that we probably have to solve together, or even I need to defer to this other person. I don't have the solution.
Yeah, very good. Very good. They are sequential. One tumbles out of the other, and they are a never-ending circle of going deeper and deeper into the problem. Well said, my friend.
Thought you'd like that one.
Take that to the bank.
Well, so you mentioned subconsciously, you know, you find yourself saying we more and more. How do we get there consciously? What does it mean to be building mutuality with someone else?
Well, I mean, that's a great question. I think you answered it just a moment ago. If you actually come into a conversation, let's just take an example. We'll make one up here. They say, Kathy, let's do a road trip today. Now, if you're going to discern levels of authority, what the first thing you'd do is, Kathy's my wife, would be discover, does she really want to do that? Does that have any appeal to her? It's a lot like on any given night here in this age of social isolation, after we play some of our board games. By the way, we are having the world championship of sequence, playing it every night. We only play until she whips me about 3 times in a row, and then I say, okay, I'm bored. And then we might go up and flick on Netflix, and I'll say, hey, we're going to watch, or let's watch another World War II documentary. Now, we've been married long enough to know that if instead I ask, what would you like to watch? A World War II documentary is never going to come up. So that's what we mean by this discerning levels of dominion. It's asking questions. But if you ask questions, you do start thinking more in terms of, well, then what are we going to watch? And if you say in a way that doesn't come off as condescending, that's the biggie on mutuality. You genuinely love this person and say, well, what would you like to watch? Well, what is it that we would like to watch? And if you could arrive at something, that's what we mean by mutuality. Now, the trick in this, Pat, in all of these that you discover in going through the Burnham Rosen training, is you'll swear in a stack of Bibles, you say we all the time. Hmm. But if you actually had a recorder in the room, if there was a drone flying overhead that could record your conversation or the way you typically talk, or what's called non-consciously talk, use I a lot more than you ever imagine. I actually had years ago a CEO in a company, I was in their round table, and he said, well, I say we all the time. And I said, okay. And then at a break, I pointed out the number of times he said I versus we. And his first thing was, no way. way. And so this idea of mutuality, it's far more than most people realize. It's what is called collaboration. And collaboration is not a strong suit of most American organizations. I refer listeners to a 2014 study by McKinsey, the consulting group. And fascinatingly enough, they found the social sector. By social sector, they would meet the not-for-profit sector. So this would be everything from hospitals to volunteer organizations to the faith community. And you'll see that they felt the one of the prevailing characteristics is they are, quote, deficient in collaboration. They don't think we, particularly in this next category of complexity, so we'll get to that in a moment, but you're exactly right that we kind of spills out of actually asking questions. And so there's an executive I'm coaching, been coaching for a couple of years, and I actually asked this person, when you go into your next meeting, see if you can actually go through the entire meeting simply asking questions, not making any declarative statements. This person's bright, very bright and gifted and extraordinarily successful. And those things just tend to make you think you know more than you think, have more authority than you think you have. And so by asking questions, this person is discovering how much they actually have in terms of dominion, which then generally promotes more of a nuanced, I wonder how we can arrive at the same place. I wonder how we can. Give you another example. A couple of weekends ago, I did a strategic planning exercise for a group, the leadership of an organization. And the first thing that I have them do on a big post-it pad, gave each one of the 14 in the room a post-it pad. I said, you have 5 minutes to go to another place in this building and draw a picture of success, how you imagine what would be impact, and come on back in. And they came in and posted the pictures. What's the first thing they noticed?
Got me.
I don't have you.
I'm going to guess the first thing they noticed is that they couldn't draw well.
That's a whole nother topic, especially amongst males in kindergarten. Every kindergartner believes they draw well. In the American educational system, which values answers over asking questions, it's very important on this whole notion of authority, but we really do value finding quick answers. Is the first thing you learn subconsciously is not to use your right brain, which loves pictures. And slowly but surely, every year, American educational system teaches kids, you can't draw. So when I began to do these exercises for companies, the first thing I noticed when I gave them these post-it pads and the number of men, bright, supposedly well-educated, first thing they go is, I can't draw. So we began to do a little exercise. I would say, okay, grab your pen. Ready? Draw a circle. Did it. Draw a vertical line coming out of the bottom of that circle. Got it. Now draw two diagonal lines extending in each direction on the bottom of that straight line. Got it. Now draw two arms. Got it. What do you have? A stick man. You can draw. Get out of here. Now back to our story. When they come back and they put these 14 post-it pads, the first thing they notice, the pictures are wildly divergent. So it's a lot like I used to joke when I flew United Airlines a lot overseas. You know, they would say the friendly skies. Now they just come out of bankruptcy. A lot of their flight attendants and pilots had lost a good chunk of their pension and retirement. And so even though the mission statement might say friendly skies, they were anything but friendly. In fact, my joke was to earn enough merit to fly international flights, you had to be middle-aged and bitchy. And that was my experience. Sit down. And I hated flying United Airlines. Sorry, listener, if you work for United. But it's an example of you can write thing one thing on paper, but then you go and draw a picture. And the picture in too many minds that I heard back then, so many years ago now, was they were just still stewing over their lost portfolios, which is fascinating to think about with what's happening with the stock market right now. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of them who were tired, they worked hard. I get it. I'm not saying they're bad people, but they're thinking, now I got to work 5 more years. And that kind of toxicity just leaks out in someone unconsciously. And so by having people draw pictures, you actually tap their right brain, their imagination. And this organization, they have 14 different ways they imagine success. In other words, they have 14, I think of success this way. No, I define success this way. No, I. There was no mutuality in this organization.
Yeah, I'm sure that's a common thing. And as a leader, that spills over into the next piece there, which is understanding complexity, understanding that
that's right.
It's not as simple as everyone being on the same page. And even that's the situation right. itself may be far more complex, so that it does inhibit people from being on the same page. United was a great example of that.
Yeah.
So do you want to talk to us about understanding complexity and thinking systems?
Sure. A simple way to think about it is that in any organization, that organization initially sees about 40% of a problem. That's what most of the findings from neuroimaging indicate. So as a result, we tend to reduce complex problems into rather simplistic formulas that really don't wrap their arms around the entire problem. When Pixar was an innovative organization, an innovative film company, they relied on these findings quite seriously. Ed Catmull writes about it in his book, Creativity, Inc. And his point would be, when we started a film project and we storyboarded the story, we assumed we only saw 40% of what would be a highly successful, visually arresting, emotionally enduring film or story. And that's when they began to do Up, which was their award-winning film that turned the company around for quite a while. But the first thing they did was bring in outsiders who helped them reshape the story over and over until they saw the other 60%. And so as Chip Heath and Dan Heath write in their book, Decisive, the average organization tends to narrow frame decisions. Narrow frame means you initially see about 40%. You don't see the complexity of the problem, and hence so many solutions fall short. And so this is what we mean by high-performing leaders start with the assumption there's more that they don't see than they do see when they look at the problem. And it's primarily they don't see the underlying systems that are causing the problem.
I love that there's this again goes back into that flow of how these things get pieced together, but there's definitely an amount of humility that it takes to embrace that. And if you start out with that approach, understanding there's likely more complexity here than we can even see. More importantly, almost there's more complexity than I can see. And so that again goes back to fueling this. Well, I must figure out, where does authority lie here? Who knows best in this room? What dominion do I have to even steer us in a direction? Should I even be the one steering us in a direction? All those questions, I think, if you start understanding the situation is far more complex, it's almost easier to discern authority and to build mutuality, because there's that humility element that's driving that.
Yes. So the stories of high-performing organizations that understand that, they're really fun to read about. They're just few and far between. Blue Wolf is one of the leading software producers today. Yet many years ago, when they were smaller, they were entirely insiders in terms of computer development, code geeks, all that stuff. I'm not belittling. I mean, they're just highly technical and qualified, but they were really stuck at one point. And it's a long story, but in the end of the day, when they're just their company leadership is out drinking one night, just trying to drown their sorrows. Jeff, the bartender, said, "Hey, I'd love to take a crack at that." And Jeff was a dropout from the University of Pennsylvania in philosophy. By the way, you philosophy majors, get ready for your future vocation. And in desperation, they called him back and said, "Hey, what the hell? Go ahead." And they flew him out to the client, came back with a $100 million contract. He just saw complexity that they didn't see. That's what outsiders do. The famous story of Southwest Airlines, when they wanted to improve turnaround time at the gate, baggage handling, boarding and unboarding, didn't turn to airline analysts. They turned to NASCAR pit crews. And NASCAR pit crews saw complexity that Southwest didn't. And that's why you can get in and off a Southwest flight, at least in my experience, faster than any other airline. That's what we mean by complexities. These outsiders see systems. Many times it's intuitive, by the way. Temple Grandin's big breakthrough in her work as an outsider. Temple Grandin, by the way, there's an HBO film based on her book, Thinking in Pictures. Grandin is an award-winning speaker who is autistic. But autism is simply the inability to control the pictures you see. All of us think in pictures. Most of us don't believe that anymore because it's been beaten out of us in the American educational system. But Grandin, when she was brought in by Colorado State University to be an outsider for organizations, the first organization was the American Beef Producers, who would lose on an average $1 billion a year because as cattle entered chutes to be slaughtered, somehow by the design of the chute, at the last second, the cattle would in some way intuit something bad is about to happen, and a chemical would be secreted into their muscle, into their meat. Now that chemical putrefies meat quicker. There's an anxiety response on the part of cattle. And the beef industry could not design a chute where that would not happen. So Temple Grandin, with no background in the industry, was invited in. She sat in a chute and she came away and said, "Try this, design it this way." And it worked. There is a humility, Pat, is what I'm picking up on in your comment. The humility is, even if you're the boss of your organization, you don't know as much as you think you know. You don't have as much dominion and authority as you imagine. And if you ask enough questions, even though it's humbling, you would go, "Oh, well, would you help me? This seems to be something we've got to work at." Yep. And if you do that in a spirit of collaboration, that is, there's a lot here I'm probably not seeing. Outsiders often see the underlying systems that are producing the problems and the complexity that comes with that. Outsiders operate with the assumption, based on that famous business saying, your system is perfectly designed to yield the results you're getting. Your system is perfectly designed to yield the results you are currently getting. I worked years ago with a tracking company. They came to me because there's about 100 tracking companies. They create hardware and software that to track trucking, the trucking industry. They couldn't get the market share they felt that they should. They felt they had a superior product, very small market share. And we went through this kind of exercise we're talking about. But I told them, Well, you shouldn't be frustrated. Your system is perfectly designed to yield the 3% market share you have. That's exactly the system you have. You just can't see it. Outsiders can see it. Pat, outsiders are a lot like your aunt and uncle who haven't been around for maybe a year or two. They come to see you at the holidays. The first thing they go is, my goodness, your kids have grown up. And you, your parents, you because you're in the warp and woof of every day, you go, huh? Outsiders just see things insiders don't. Insiders are not inferior. They simply have to have their nose to the grindstone. They are in the minutia, but they don't see as much as they think they see. And this is particularly a plague, to do a bit of a pivot here. Christian Smith at Notre Dame has noticed this is a particular plague in the faith community because it doesn't tend to see the systems creating the problems that they seek to address. To their credit, the American faith community really cares about the poor, the vulnerable. And this pandemic is really trying to do great things to help out as many of the poor and disadvantaged as possible. And I in no way diminish that. But what the faith community has not done for over 100 years is actually attempt to address the systems that create systemic poverty. And so Smith, many years ago, what we're left doing is having to do missions of mercy to help those at the tail end of a system. But we hardly ever attempt to address the system, because once you step into trying to change a system, the complexity is astounding. And by the way, you would also recognize this is going to take a huge collaborative effort. Back to the we, but systemic problems are always more difficult and complex than most people imagine.
Yeah, this started to collide for me when we've done that exercise, and we've even talked about it here, but just running through, I think the classic is, how do you make toast? And we sort of started to flush out, oh, that's easy. You put a piece of bread in the toaster. Okay, well, where did the toaster come from? Okay, well, what did you do with the toaster? Did you just leave it on the counter? No, you plug it in. Okay, where'd the power come from? And you draw, I mean, the complexity required just to make a darn piece of toast is incredible.
It really is.
Yeah, that's where things start to swirl. Similar overlap for me was connecting the dots between what you're talking about here and round tables. Again, that's where all of this starts to kind of come together. You realize, oh, there's something here that we've sort of already talked about. And that's that whole idea of putting together a round table, whether it's personal, whether it's organizational, but understanding the inside or outside or the left side, the right side. If listeners have no idea what I'm talking about, I think there are a couple good episodes on that. I definitely encourage listening to those, because I think it helps put some context into this idea of outsiders, which, totally bleeds over into complexity.
That's right. And listeners ought to know, we do shameless advertising for our podcasts all the time. So nobody else is going to promote them. So we're going to promote them. Yeah. And also, I say yes, yes, yes to what you just observed, because I get it. I get it that if you begin to talk about systems, the average person, even the extraordinary person, is going to go, oh my God, this is just way beyond me. I can't change a system. Small wonder then that Christianity America is often called privately engaging, but publicly irrelevant. It's inconsequential, because we just kind of shrug our shoulders and say, I'm just going to focus on my personal relationship with God. But think about it in this way. Say I run a service station here in town. Well, I'm part of a system where I'm selling gas now for about $2 a gallon. And I can't make money at that. But that system goes all the way back to even a few months ago, Saudi Arabia deciding it's going to try to bankrupt Russia. Russia's main source of revenues is oil. Saudi Arabia, as you know, is in a giant modernization program fueled almost entirely by oil revenues. And that right now is creating dissension and a problem because they're beginning to run deficits. And so how do you clear out the competition, mainly Russia, is to start to produce more oil and drive the price down. Now, the world's leading exporter now of oil, as you probably know, is the United States. And that's primarily through shale. But shale is not profitable below $35, $40 a barrel. Oil is now selling at $20. So if you're a shale producer, you're part of a system where you're at risk of being bankrupt. But you're also, if you're just a local operator, you're going, well, what can I do? There's not much you can do except high-performing leaders begin to go, well, if we don't change the system, and so if we don't, say, form a coalition of independent operators, and in some way try to gain some kind of capital or authority or dominion, then we'll forever just be at the whims of the system. Now, I understand that some candidates try to win elections by saying the system is rigged. I think that's victim mentality. That's not how leaders think. The system isn't necessarily rigged. The system has simply been developed by people who have earned some sort of capital, social, cultural, financial, to shape the system. And what the church did for 1600 years, at least, if not 1700, was it thought systems and created systems that tried to bring about human flourishing. We don't think systems much anymore. We just think individuals and helping them. And while that has tremendous merit, we don't think systems. And so I'm not thinking systems. We're not a high-performing faith community, as high-performing would be defined by these findings from neuroimaging, because they do understand complexity and things, systems. So this is everywhere. It's why, by the way, some readers might want to pick up the book, The Influentials. And the point is, it's not necessarily CEOs and wealthy people, but these characteristics that you were talking about here characterize influentials. And the point of the book is, throughout history, it generally is no more than 10% of a population. I don't know why, but it generally is. So if you're a listener, first of all, I hope we're drawing listeners who want to be influential. That's what it means by having dominion, which is that's the human job description that God gave to us in Genesis 1. Be fruitful and multiply and have dominion. We're supposed to be people who are earning capital and having dominion. But for some reason throughout history, and this goes right around the globe, it is not particular to any geography, any ethnicity, no more than 10% of a population actually seeks to have dominion. And then having dominion, they try to rightfully discern, they build mutuality, and they think systems. And first, I knew a CEO years ago, he used to joke, 10% of the population wants to change the world, and the other 90% watches television. Now, okay, give him credit for saying something memorable. Now I would say, watch the big screen. But I have to tell you, there's a lot of evidence kind of supporting that. Because thinking systems, I get it. I know a man who is trying to change the system of the American university system, which right now, by and large, even though the church founded the modern university way back in the 9th century, 10th century, right now, in most American universities, the faith couldn't get its foot in the door in the provost office. We can, as some of my friends up at an Ivy League school say, they can do cat burglar evangelism. So when the lights are off and the guards are down, they can slip over the wall and try to go in and save a student or two. But when the lights turn back on and people go to class, faith is meaningless. The very faith that created the university they're going to can't get a foot in the door anymore. It's part of a system. And so this man and the work he's doing says this is a 100-year project to return the modern university back to its original system, a 100-year project. He's thinking systems. He understands complexity.
Mike, I'm thinking about the audience who might be hearing this, and different, you know, they may be different ages. And I'm thinking if you're in college or younger, it's likely one of the biggest problems you may face is being overly ambitious and ignorant to the complexity of the world. And so I resonate with that, where you have this mindset of, I want to be influential and I want to change the world. But there's just simply not enough experience and season of life to help you realize it's far more complex. You have to think systems. There's a piece there that I just never understood. And so a big important piece to all of this is, like, the good news of that, if you're much younger, is you have plenty of time to practice this. But it's going to be really hard to practice without having some semblance of a mentor or a round table or someone to actually call you out when you say need, and I. That's really helpful. But then as we go kind of on, like you said, there are some people who may be in a later stage of life, and you may be working at the local service station and thinking, well, there's no way I'm going to change this worldwide system of how gas flows through the U.S. That's just, it's not going to be change. And the reality is, you're probably right. But as you mentioned, well, if you are a believer and you do want to talk about living out your faith well, God didn't just tell us to put our heads down and read our Bibles every day. Like he very clearly from the beginning said, exercise dominion and exercise it well. And so part of this may seem fruitless if the only thing you're considering is your ability to change a systemic problem worldwide. Yeah, sure. You likely never will. But at the end of your life, can you say you stewarded well the dominion you were given? And I think that's a big piece. That's great. Like, that itself is enough to say, I did this well. But to not even approach it, I think, misses a really important facet of our faith that is neglected today. So I say that because if you're young, there's a lot to learn. So yes, put this into practice. If you're older, you feel like your time is run out, there's still plenty to learn. It may be for a different goal, but it is for that stewarding the dominion you've been given well. So at the end of the day, you know, you can receive that. Well done, my good and faithful servant. There's dominion plays a big part in that.
So well said. So listeners understand, the old man who just said that just turned what?
Just turned 30.
Ah. So how about that? Talking about them young people.
You know, I feel like I'm just coming out of college every year.
Hey, I feel like I'm 19 on the inside. But hey, Pat makes a great point. If you're in your 20s, I'm mentoring some young people in their 20s, and sometimes they get their knickers in a knot and they really want to change the world. And I said, my friend Dylan recently said, Dylan, what was I doing when I was in my 20s? He goes, I don't know. I said, exactly my point. You get to be my age, no one's going to know what you were doing. What you should be doing is building capital. And that means if you want to have influence in the tech world, which tends to, unfortunately, too often turn a blind eye to the negative side effects, then get good at that in your 20s. Couldn't become a rabbi until you were 30. Jesus didn't start his public ministry until he was 30. You generally can't become a priest in most older traditions until you turn 30. To Pat's point, the 20s really are where you burn the candle at both ends. If you want to climb a mountain in Tibet, climb it. But you ought to be thinking about, if I'm going to be taken seriously and actually change systems, this is my time to invest. I'll give you an example. One of my proteges, I think he just turned 30. But in his 20s, he wants to change the educational system. So a couple of years back, I recommended, then go to a darn good graduate school of education. If you go to some podunk school, you've immediately kept your ceiling pretty low. And he did. It cost him a lot of time, money, hard work, but it began to give him what's called cultural capital. Now, on the other side of the coin, you're right. You say, okay, what if you're my age? I'm 65. And you go, too late, probably go to grad school and education and try to change the system. It's never too late in this regard. Because I began to feel like in my 40s, have I blown it, God? God, you kind of wrecked me, you know? You didn't really teach me this stuff when I was younger. Thanks, God. But you have to come to a place where you go, God doesn't make any mistakes. First of all, he probably looked at me and said, well, you ain't the smartest guy in the room. I don't think that'd be a great investment of your time. And second, I think for boomers ought to become John the Baptists in this regard. I'm not saying we have to become Baptists, but yeah, we don't have time. I'll tell you a quick joke. So Charles Spurgeon, the famous preacher in the early 1800s, England, he didn't grow up knowing Christ, and his mother prayed fervently that he would come to faith. And when he did, he came and told his mom, he says, I become a Christian. I'm Baptist. And she goes, oh, Christian, a Baptist. So when I say John the Baptist, for all our Baptist viewers, I love you. But for John the Baptist, remember he said, I must decrease, he must increase. I think a great boomer legacy would be if we decreased. By that I mean that you should have, at my age, some assets. They may be financial, they may be experience, so on and so forth. But I think you ought to invest in younger generations about the very things we're talking about and begin to die to yourself. God makes no mistakes, but boomers have famously not thought about systems, at least the boomers who are believers. Now, nor had the Judeans when they were deported to Babylon. In the Babylonian exile, God said, you're going to be here 70 years. 702 generations. Now, I know there were a couple of false prophets there. Kingpins back in Jerusalem and said, guys, it's not that bad. Hananiah was one of them. We're not really in exile. We haven't been that bad. We'll be home in a couple of years, back to Jerusalem. God said, ignore them. So let's just say, Pat, you 30, I'm 65. Okay, I'm 65, which is just about the ceiling on what a person that time would live. So that means I'm never going home. I'm never returning to Jerusalem. So what do? Just sit there at the rivers of Babylon and cry and feel pity party and feel bad for myself? And God has so hurt me and wounded me and disappointed me. And God, I thought you were safe and loving and kind and gentle, and you're so mean. And what's happened to my home back in Jerusalem? It's probably falling apart. Someone's probably taken it over. My whole portfolio is back there. No, he could have said and said, okay, look at these young children here. I'm going to pour my life into them. You're 30. Are you going home to Jerusalem one day? Are you returning?
Likely not.
Nope. I don't think so. You'd have to live one to be 100, Pat. Not going to happen. I think part of, if you assume the American church is in exile, is I have no idea how long it takes for us to return to the impact of earlier traditions that thought systems complexity, understood authority, understood mutuality. But it might be 50 years, it might be 40 years. I don't know. That's not the point. The point is, if you're older, you can sit, gripe, ignore, check out, decide you want to play, what's that? It's not paddleball. It's a new rage here for older people. Down on a tennis court. See, you can tell I don't even play it. You play golf, chase a white ball, travel, decide you're going to dine, you're going to be a tourist the rest of your life. You can do all sorts of things and ignore this. That's what 90% will probably do. Or you can gripe, complain, or you can say, I've been part of a system that's created this. Pogo, we have met the enemy. He is us. Stop blaming the world, the flesh, and the devil. And say, okay, then I'm going to transfer whatever assets I have to the youngest generation I could, in the full knowledge that they might have better capacity to change the system. But it's unlikely we will. It's unlikely Gen X will. That'd be one way to do it, Pat.
Yeah, you're right.
For the sake of listening, we'll push on to the fourth one, which is simply this. So again, in summary, they discern authority. They say we more highly impactful leaders discern, first of all, levels of dominion. But in discerning, you just naturally drift more towards we rather than, well, I'm just going to do this and I'm going to do that. They think systems, they understand complexity, and they understand every problem is systemic. Almost every problem requires a systemic solution. And then fourth one is called focus on results. And focus on results, this is a fun and easy way to think about it. Low impact people, when you get to an end of a process, use what I call soft words or fuzzy words. And fuzzy words are things like, let me get back to you on that. Or, let's consider that. Or let's pray about that. I'm not against prayer, by the way, please. Let's think about it. High impact leaders say things like this instead. I'll get back to you at 3 o'clock today on that. I intend to put together a one-page summary and get this to you by 5 p.m. today. I'm prepared to do this and this over the next 48 hours for us to review and then plan on our next steps. Do you hear the difference?
Yeah, for sure. And another one I think is seeing a meeting agenda, which I say this all the time, but let's discuss this thing versus right. here are the four questions that we want to answer in this meeting.
Very good. Good little book on this. A friend of mine put me onto it, Intentional Leadership. And it's written by, I think, a man out of the military, but his point is who trained in the military to say, I intend to do this and this and this. And you're right, date, time, place, all the what, where, how, when questions. Ineffective leaders, they fuzzy out in the end. They fuzzy out for one simple reason. Then you don't have to focus on results. You can actually make up results. So we're famous, for example, of I knew years ago a young man. He was in the pastorate at that time, but his church had done a lot of wonderful work with homeless and the poor and a lot of food drives. But he come to the end of his rope. And he said, because we really don't focus on results, you know, other than okay, we fed 1,000 people at Thanksgiving. But he said, we could do that till the cows come home. We weren't changing any systems. And it was a very minimalistic focus versus, so he, you know, he's moved on to try to do something that would be more systemic. But I hear this all the time, especially if I come to an end of a meeting and they say, well, this was a great meeting. And, let's think about some of the things that we talked about, and the next time we get together, we'll sort of consider them some more. Guess what's going to be done about that between meetings?
Nothing.
There you go. So high-performing leaders discern levels of authority. They say we more than I. They understand the what's called mutuality. They understand complexity, so they think systems. And they focus on results because you see strong, clear, measurable, actionable verbs when they talk.